Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
On legal, I'm your co-host, Mike Letters. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, Tommy, we're coming up on the big day.
Yep. Big day where I lose my leg.
You're not going to lose your leg, hopefully.
I lost a leg, but I gained a knee.
You're going to be going in for some sort of knee surgery, right?
Yeah, knee replacement.
You're going under the knife.
Take out the old one and put in a new one.
Well, since you're going to have surgery coming up pretty soon, I figured this would be a perfect time to talk about medical malpractice and all the things that could go wrong with surgery.
No, this is a terrible time to talk about that. I don't want to hear about all the things that could go wrong. I want to hear about the things that went right. My brother, by coincidence, just got his knee replaced this week.
Yeah.
His surgery was Monday. Mine's Friday. And the doctor came out and told his wife afterwards, said, well, the operation went well. And I said, that's it? Just well? I want him to come out after mine and say, it was the best one I've ever done. It was the, you know, the masterpiece of all knee operations.
There must be like a limited shelf life on Smurl knees. They both go out at the same time like that.
I blame it on my mother. My mother had to have her knees replaced, and I think she just passed on her degenerative knees to her sons. My dad's got good knees. He's still pedaling around at 85, and my mom, she hadn't walked for a while.
So maybe the knees are handed down from father, from mother to son.
Yeah, it's just like baldness.
Baldness. that's an old wives' tale, I think. I don't know if it's true or not. It seems to be true.
You know, if we had a doctor amongst us, we could probably ask the doctor. They would probably have an opinion.
Well, we might be in luck.
We have a very special guest with us tonight, considering that the topic is malpractice.
I know. So, I know you don't want to go forward with the medical malpractice episode, but I think since we have a doctor in the house, we should probably go forward with it. What do you think?
Is there a doctor in the house? Yes.
Yes. I'm here.
Dr. Sydney Smurl McElroy has
Welcome
joined us.
Thank you. Thanks for
coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
The star of Still Buffering and Sawbones and My Daughters.
don't tell the other ones that.
I never tell them. You're my favorite, and I never tell them that you are.
Don't tell them that.
My favorite niece.
They're going to get so mad.
They don't listen anyway. They won't know. They're too busy.
Hey.
They don't have time to listen to us. Who wants to listen to their dad, their uncle? People don't listen to their dad and uncle.
Do.
People that listen to us, we're not their dad or their uncle.
No, a lot of people do.
a lot of nieces and nephews.
A lot of nieces and nephews.
And daughters and sons.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I should have had more kids. That would boost our ratings.
That's right. Push us over that.
You're not doing your share there, Mike.
Well, I brought three more into the fold.
Well, that's true. We got to birth our own listeners.
That's right.
That's been my plan, I guess.
You got two more growing there.
You're doing well.
That's right. Charlie makes her own podcast sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So, are you having now? You have two bad knees, right?
Two bad knees.
But they're only doing one, right?
They will only do one at a time because Sydney may know more about this than me, but I think that it has to do with they get better outcomes that way.
Yeah. The big thing is like the recovery period. You can do better if you just rehab one at a time. It's a faster surgery. I mean, the longer you're under anesthesia, the higher risk. And so it's better to do one at a time. And plus, like in a worst case, and I'm not saying this to scare you.
We got all these bad things we're going to talk about before I go in and go to get put out.
This doesn't happen very often, but in like a worst case scenario that you were to get an infection afterwards.
Uh-huh.
If you get an infection in a prosthetic joint, in a fake joint, that's a big deal. They have to remove the joint for a period of time. Sometimes leave you without a joint for a while you get IV antibiotics. And if you've got two fake joints, they have to do that with both of them. So while if it goes perfectly, that is better. There's so much risk. It's just easier to do one at a time.
Taking the safe way.
Yeah.
Man, anybody tell me they're going to remove a joint of any type, I don't want it done.
Now, which
they kind of are. I mean, that's
well,
what
that's true. But they're going to put one back.
Put one back.
It's a swap.
You get a
let's say that. They're not going to take it out. It's a swap. It's an even swap. No, I get the better end of the deal, I hope.
You're going to be like an android after this.
Yeah. What, now, tell me this. They told me in the class, I had to go to a mandatory 3-hour class to learn about all the things they were going to do to me and what to expect before, during, and after. And they said, infection in the body is drawn to metal.
Mm-hmm.
Why does metal draw infection? I mean,
just any foreign body is an easy like source of bacteria. It's just a place where bacteria will easily set up shop and start growing. Any kind of foreign body.
Mm. So what about like those things where people are getting different data and stuff injected like into their bodies? That would be a source of infection there too.
I mean, you can make things. People? Yeah, the things like the barcode type like things.
Yeah.
In theory, anything. I mean, they obviously like prosthetic joints and things like that are made to not like grow bacteria, but anything theoretically could.
So
it's always a risk.
It's kind of like the drywall you put up in the bathroom. Like it's supposed to be mold, mildew and mold resistant as opposed to the drywall you put up other places, which is not.
Right.
Hmm.
But,
I hope they don't drywall my knee.
I don't know if drywall is like that, but I mean, even with the best technology, it still messes up sometimes.
So they're only going to do the one.
And which one are they doing?
The right one.
So they decide they're going to do the right one first.
Yeah, not the correct one, but the right one.
The correct one, the right one.
They're both in bad shape. It's funny. The right one gives me more pain, but the left one, when they measured it, I have less mobility in my left knee than I do in my right. But the right one's the one that hurts the most. So they said, let's do the one that hurts the most first.
Sure.
Well, the reason I was asking is because whenever you go in for surgery, during your pre-op and everything, they always ask you very specifically what procedure are they doing, you know, what exactly, you know, what arm or what are they working on. They'll ask you your name, your birthday, and they do it like to the point where it's almost ridiculous. They do it over and over and over again because they really want to make sure they're doing the right thing.
Is this a trick question?
Yeah.
They do that after you're in the OR and you're asleep or you could be awake. I guess it depends because I've heard it for both of my C-sections.
Mm-hmm.
And they do what's called the timeout. And the last thing they do before they start the procedure is everybody agrees here. This is the patient's name. This is what they're here for. This is the surgery. This is the limb or whatever, what we're doing. It's like everyone in the room has to stop what they're doing and agree on that thing. And then they move forward.
Well, I read some cases here that I have where that took place and they still did it wrong.
Wow.
Well, I mean, I think
I'm going to draw a big X on my knee.
Well,
I'm going to take a felt tip pen and draw an X on my knee.
I think they usually do, actually.
Yeah, they do that, actually. Yeah, but someone should do that. Yeah.
I think somebody did that to me once when I had one of my knees worked on when I had it scoped. I've had both of them scoped before. Of course, that's not nearly as invasive a procedure as this.
Sure, sure.
Well, you know, your downside, I guess, worst case scenario, they operate it in the wrong knee. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, I had to have it done anyway.
I was going
to
say, yeah.
I'm going to ask them if they can do it somewhere from November to December anyway, get the other one done. So.
Yeah.
Maybe I'd get the second one free in that case. If they did the wrong one, then they'd still owe me the correct one. Maybe I'd get one like a BOGO.
If they did the wrong leg and all you wanted in return was just the other one done for free, you probably would get that.
Hey, I'm easy.
That seems like a deal they'd take.
I got a couple friends that are
I'm going to throw them a curveball.
They may want to talk to if that happens.
Yeah, I'm going to throw them a curveball there. I might zig on them or zag on them or something there, you know?
We might get some new...
It's the left one.
We might get a new studio for recording after.
Yeah,
I was going to say, I wouldn't settle for just a free other knee. Because they'd be like, oh, yeah, yes,
it's like
definitely.
Kramer and Seinfeld. I reached a different settlement, and it's him on the billboard.
Yeah.
I was like, what'd you do?
Well, we're also back in our old digs, huh? Back at recording in McElroy Studios.
Yeah, we are.
Even though we haven't changed our intro and outro to indicate that. That we left, that we went to our house.
We're back here in the McElroy Studios.
Where we started, that birthed us.
Well, welcome home.
Thanks.
That's an odd
Thanks
one.
For welcoming us back in your basement.
No problem. Thank you for coming. It's easier because my baby isn't sleeping. So
yes,
so
if anything happens, you're here.
Hand.
Well, now, medical malpractice, you know, basically you ask yourself, what is medical malpractice? And essentially, it's basically just like a regular old run-of-the-mill negligence case. Like we've talked about many different times, there's your basic duty, breach, cause, and damages.
Duty.
But it
I always remember that one.
He nails that second element.
I was going to say, do you always do that? Is it like you have any time the word? Okay.
That always catches me off guard. Well, I just never expect it. I don't know why, but I never expect it.
There was, by now.
There was one time I didn't, and he stopped mid next paragraph and said, "You didn't repeat duty."
I'm thrown.
But anyway, like I said, the four elements: duty, breach, cause, damages. But basically, it's negligence that pertains to medical procedures and medical care. So it's kind of dubbed medical malpractice. But essentially, it's really not much different than your run-of-the-mill kind of auto accident type case where somebody had some sort of duty and they breached it and caused some damages to you. Same thing. You know, it's basically some sort of medical professional has some sort of duty, they breached it, and then they caused damages to you. So it's very, very similar kind of type thing. It's just because it's medical malpractice and they're professionals, they're held to a bit of a higher standard. And, you know, we strive for excellence, I guess, with that. So
I hate it when my duty's breached.
And I would like to say, I'm hoping to point out, I am on the show in my capacity as a physician, and that is where my expertise in this ends. I have never been named in a medical malpractice suit, just to make that clear. I didn't want it to be like, I'm here because
now,
of
Cindy,
all
Cindy, you've been sued a lot.
You've got lots of experience.
You're the most negligent doctor in town. How do you handle it?
I was deposed one time, but not... I was not named in the suit. I was just like a treating physician witness or whatever.
Yeah.
That was it. I've never been... So far, knock on wood, I have not been sued.
Yes.
Yes.
Do they go through any type of training with you on that, either in med school or at the hospital or anything like that? Do you all go through some kind of classes about it or something?
We do. We talk about it some in med school, but the main training as a resident and as an attending has been risk management sessions that we have to attend yearly, where they usually lawyers do the session. They bring local lawyers in, like the lawyers for the hospital and stuff, to go through some cases with us and then just talk about different risk issues and like go through the basics and things like that. So
I believe my law firm is one of the firms that does medical malpractice defense, I think.
Do they?
I think so, yeah. I think we were talking about one time, and I think that the attorney that prepped you for your depo was the attorney at my firm.
Yes, that's right, yeah. That was so scary. They told me, and I don't know if this is always true, but he told me that the way that they get doctors is that they will ask you a question, and when you answer yes or no, you're going to sound dumb. No matter what you say, you'll sound kind of dumb, but just say yes or no, and then like do your best to keep your mouth shut. And it really is true. They ask you questions, and when you just say no, I feel like, now I sound like an idiot, and I want to say a bunch more stuff. Right. And it was so hard to bite my tongue and just, nope, and just sit there going, ugh.
Well, that's a good depo prep technique for anybody, really, because they can only, if you ask somebody a question and they say yes or no, they've answered your question you asked.
Mm-hmm.
But if you ask somebody a question and they say yes, but blah, 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 then you're going to say, oh, really? Well, what about blah, 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 blah? And then they say, well, about blah, 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 blah.
And your own words will sink you.
Yeah, and then you say, well, tell me more about blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I've run the same problem, even though it wasn't malpractice. I used to, when I worked for the railroad, and people would sue the railroad due to injuries. And if I was the officer on duty or something like that, it was somebody on there.
Duty. I got you that time.
Yeah, you dutied me.
Not in the studio.
you'd end up being deposed as part of that lawsuit. And that was one of the things that they would prep you and tell you ahead of time. Just answer yes or no. Don't try to defend you. They're going to try to make you look stupid. They're going to try to make you look like you didn't know what was going on, that you didn't do your job, that you were treating them unfairly. That's their job. You just sit there and answer yes or no. And yeah, it's the same thing. You're like, well, the guy was an idiot, you know? Well, you can't say that. You know?
No, and they would, every time they would address me, they'd go, well, Dr. McElroy. It's like, every time.
You don't even deserve the title,
I know,
right?
Doctor. Like,
do you even have a real license?
And they put in air quotes, well, Dr. McElroy.
That's how it felt.
Are you calling my credentials into question?
I always think of when deposing doctors, that movie Malice with Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
Where he goes off on a title.
I am God.
Yeah. He was in operating room number 8. He doesn't like to be second guessed.
I was a terrified resident. I didn't say anything like that. I think I just sat there going, no, yes.
Well, that's what he's. They had him on the witness stand, and they said something like, you think as a surgeon you have the right to play God? And he goes, I am God. But what you didn't know, there was a twist, and I don't think this is a spoiler since the movie came out 25 years ago. but he was actually,
in case you want to see this movie, I guess.
Yeah, go ahead and turn it down real quick.
But he was in on it with the person that was malpracticed on. So he was the doctor that did it.
Malpracticed on.
Yeah, he was the doctor that did it, but then her and him met in the Bahamas to split the money.
Ooh.
Well, to go in together on the money.
And if you haven't seen it, you probably still don't even understand what Tommy just said.
I understood what I said.
I know.
It's usually the way of it.
I thought it was perfectly clear.
He did it on purpose to file a malpractice insurance claim for the victim.
Yes.
Ah.
And then they were together.
Very safe way of saying it.
They acted like they were, at odds, but actually they were together.
They were in cahoots.
Yeah. They went to the Bahamas and to a love shack or something like that.
In the deposition I was in, I want to ask if this happens a lot. One of the lawyers said that they were getting heated with each other. I was just sitting watching as it was getting heated, and one objected to something that one said, and then the other one replied with, "I object to your face." Does that kind of thing happen a lot?
It should.
I swear to you, this happened. He went, "Well, I object to your face."
I've seen a lot of lawyers' faces I've objected to.
No, that does not actually happen very often. I don't even know.
He was making faces in response to the, that's what he meant. It wasn't just like a...
Just a burn. No, I thought it was just a sick burn.
It was like he had a look on his face like, you're an idiot. And so he was like, I object to your face. And I don't know.
I heard ones that got confrontational. Somebody put one on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
That the two in a deposition got confrontational with each other. They were going to go out in the hall and fight.
I mean, I've probably done... I mean, I'm maybe 1,000 depositions. I have no idea. I mean, I've done a lot of depositions. And out of all that, I've only had one, maybe two, that ever got a little bit confrontational. And then, but basically, it wasn't my fault.
Well, this wasn't my fault. It had nothing to do with it. It kind of went on around me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Some people are just jerks. They might be lawyers. They might not be lawyers, but some people are just jerks. So.
Well, that's true. The world is filled with them.
That's right.
Most of them drive. Because I encounter them coming to and from work.
Your dad becomes a curmudgeonly old man.
And they have Ohio license
Most
plates.
Most of them are driving in front of me.
And whenever I get behind somebody from another state, I think, they drove all the way from the other state just so they could be here in front of me, keeping me from getting to work on time.
They're going slow in the grocery store. Their grocery carts are not putting them away. Kids these days.
Now, if I'm walking, I'm usually the one holding up traffic.
Get off my lawn.
Like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Well, so in addition to like being just not simple, but usually the medical malpractice cases are a bit more complicated because the things that are going into them. But there's a lot more kind of different steps that are involved with medical malpractice cases. Prior to filing suit, for example, in West Virginia, you have to get what's called a pre-screening letter. And this is basically a letter from a doctor stating that the possible claim has merit. Sometimes it's actually called a letter of merit, crazily enough. But this is an extra step that you have to file before you file a lawsuit, at least finding one doctor who practices in that same area that has examined your possible claim and says, there may be something here. Now, in practice, is that really that much of a hurdle? No, because they don't have to be in the same area. They can be from wherever. They just have to be some sort of doctor who does kind of the same stuff that can say like, yeah, you got a claim. Sure.
You're probably not going to find a doctor from that same practice that will write you that letter, though.
Oh, like one of their partners or something?
Right.
No.
they pay
their insurance. Or from the same hospital or anything else.
They pay
else.
Their insurance premiums together, so probably not.
No.
There's a few more steps. And additionally, I want to talk about, but I think before we get into that, maybe there might be some motions.
Yes, your doctor lawyership. We would like to approach the bench to pay court costs.
All right. Who do we have on the docket?
We have our good friends from DollarShaveClub.com.
Now, no matter what you do in the bathroom to get ready.
But don't tell us what it is. We don't want to know any of your private stuff. Whatever you do to get ready.
Hey,
I listen to this, but don't tell us what this stuff is.
It's my duty to get ready.
It's your duty? You're getting your duty ready?
Dollar Shave Club has everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. They have amazing shower stuff, hairstyling products, toothbrushes and toothpaste, and of course, razors and shave supplies.
And One Wipe Charlie's. They're amazing butt wipes.
They make you tingle.
Now, Mike, we've used a lot of the different stuff from Dollar Shave Club.
Oh, yeah. I think probably just almost about everything, I think.
I mean, their razors are top-notch. The shave butter is, I mean, it's excellent.
What do you think about the beard oil, Tommy?
Well, seeing as how I don't have a beard, I would have to rub it on my head, and I'm not sure that head oil is the same thing as beard oil.
Let me tell you.
But you'll have to recommend the beard oil, because I know you use it, and your beard is extremely luxurious.
Yes, I love the beard oil. It's very good. It makes me feel very lush.
I like running my fingers through your beard when you have the beard oil in.
I must have been asleep, because I don't remember you doing that, and that is very creepy.
Well, just don't wake up easily. But if we put you under anesthesia, I'll give you a shot of my stuff.
This is a weird ad, guys.
Sometimes now, they just go that way.
Now, you might have to shave your whole body to get ready for a bike race. And Dollar Shave Club's executive razor and shave butter can help.
They do more than help. They do the job. You'd become very aerodynamic. Or what if you were swimming? You might not want to have a stray hair there. It might slow you down. You beat Michael Phelps.
And I'll tell you what. I know I have to get my hair ready for a soccer match. Boogies by Dollar Shave Club can get your style just right.
It can get your boogie on. The thing is, no matter what you do to get ready, Dollar Shave Club has everything you need.
And right now, you can get ready with an amazing deal on any one of their starter sets.
I recommend the Daily Essentials starter set because I love the Amber Lavender Body Cleanser. But you can't go wrong with any of them.
Head on over to dollarshaveclub.com/court to pick up your own Dollar Shave Club starter set for just $5.
After your starter set, products ship at regular price. And make sure you check out their new video, too.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court.
That's dollarshaveclub.com/court. Just tell them Mike and Tommy sent you.
Now, some of the other things that these medical malpractice cases require, especially in West Virginia, well, not in West Virginia, this one, but they may require that you have some sort of pre-suit mediation or arbitration before actually filing a suit. So basically, before the court has jurisdiction to hear a medical malpractice case, you have to go to mediation or arbitration and try to resolve it or have an arbitrator try to resolve it. So
can't we all just get along?
And that's one of the things where basically the court would not have subject matter jurisdiction to the case until you do that before it happens.
So you have to go to mediation. It just has to be one of those things where neither side would meet. I mean, they would go there and one wouldn't come down or one wouldn't come up or whatever.
And it's the same thing with that pre-screening letter. There's no subject matter jurisdiction until that's done either. But in practice, honestly, if you file it early, the courts are pretty forgiving to allow you to get one later on or to amend it. As long as you're within the statute of limitations, which for medical malpractice cases is generally shortened as well.
6 months to 2 years or something like that.
It's 2 years in West Virginia, so you actually have to commence the suit within 2 years. And basically, the two-year period begins at either the time the injury or the date the claimant reasonably or should have discovered the injury, or in cases involving death, whenever the person passed away.
That's a pretty good evidence that something went wrong when you passed away.
Sometimes people just pass away.
When you stop ticking, the clock starts ticking.
That's a good way to look at it.
Okay.
Now, in cases that are with children, they're a little bit younger. They give the children a little bit longer statute of limitations. It has to be within 2 years of the date of injury or prior to the claimant's 12th birthday, whichever is longer. So I guess it gives a little bit of time for that injury to manifest. Because the kid might not be able to articulate what happened to him, so they want to give him a little bit more time to figure out.
Never know what happened to him. Charlie's legs will look like bananas. And you say, Charlie, where did you get that? I don't know.
Well,
kids don't know what happened to them. Their parents would know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can wait till the kid turns 12. You wait till the kid turns 21. He probably wouldn't know. The parents are the ones that are going to know. They always know those things. They keep track of their little sweethearts.
Hopefully. I mean, you hope so.
The kids never know.
I got some cases where the parents don't, but we don't want to talk about that.
I was going to say.
that's a different topic altogether.
I can think of lots of things, but.
Additionally,
yeah.
Medical malpractice cases generally have a cap on the limits on the recovery for non-economic damages. Mm-hmm. Here in West Virginia, they're capped at $250,000 or $500,000 for catastrophic cases. And then
is that total or just for
non-economic?
Okay, for like pain and suffering, exactly. Stuff like that. So in other words, if you can prove, what about things like loss of wages or something included in there?
That would be an economic damage.
Okay.
So say basically there's some sort of medical malpractice and you are the person's a 25-year-old professional athlete and you amputate their leg by mistake. Well, you can basically
figure what their career would be worth.
What their career would be worth and add that in. That would be an economic damage. And then, but then it would be capped for the pain and suffering or non-economic punitive damages at $250,000 or $500,000.
Okay. It seems low.
It is. And I think caps on non-economic damages is kind of one of those knee-jerk reactions that gets pushed through pretty quickly. And it really only hurts people who are really, really hurt.
Yeah.
Well, I think West Virginia did that because they were always each year voted as a judicial hellhole.
Yeah.
They reached the top of that list every year. And in an effort by the legislature to try to improve the conditions, they may have swung that pendulum too far the other way.
Well, they want to bring business here.
Yeah.
How's that working out for us?
Yeah. How does that factor in? Because what I would wonder about is, like, we talked about children, but somebody who sustains some kind of injury, like maybe a child during the childbirth process, mm-hmm. and if that person now has like chronic disabilities that they're going to need lots of care.
Yeah.
Is that all factored in the economic losses?
Well,
like somebody who maybe now will not be able to have a job maybe their entire life. And
right.
I mean, cause,
and medical care, if they had to have continuing medical care, that's an economic loss too, right?
Absolutely.
So that's not capped.
That's factored in there.
No, that's not capped either.
Okay. Cause I'm just thinking like somebody like that, 250, 500,000, that doesn't even.
Yeah.
No. So that's all separate buckets that you can go to.
It's 250, 500. That's talking about non-economic pain and suffering, punitive damages. These are the kind of things that are meant to punitive. It's meant to punish. So
right. You're
trying to punish someone for what they did.
But that doesn't punish a hospital.
Yeah.
$500,000 is nothing to a hospital.
But yet, you know what? The national average.
They got lots of money. I don't have it, but the hospitals do.
The national average of a malpractice lawsuit is?
What?
$242,000.
That's the average recovery?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, there's a reason why attorneys keep doing it.
Yeah. But what I'm saying is that would just be that one piece. That wouldn't even take into all the others. I mean, that seems kind of low. There must be a lot of less ones that are settled because, you know, there's some big ones. There must be a lot of lower ones if the average is only 242.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think your average negligence case is probably, you know, probably $5,000 to $10,000 if your average.
Oh, they're not all like life and death or loss of wrong limb or something like that.
Practice. I'm talking about just run-of-the-mill negligence type cases, slip and fall, auto accident, thing like that. It's pretty low. It's 5 to 10. Mm-hmm. But I think your average medical malpractice, I mean, I would say it's probably up there.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I can't talk about cases because
they're very
quiet and very hush hush about medical malpractice settlements. So, but I think they're definitely several rungs higher on the numerical food chain.
It's hard. I can imagine why, because like if you're the hospital, if you're the entity responsible, then that hurts your. I mean, that they advertise, and I'm sure that hurts them from an advertising perspective. I mean, I've heard of nursing homes in the area who have just closed after some of these big suits.
Right. Well, that's a nursing home abuse is actually like a subset of medical malpractice to a degree.
Is it?
And it's kind of its own little niche market as well.
But I know, like, doctors who, after going through some of these cases, just are never the same. I mean, that just they want to keep it hush because they never emotionally recover from that process.
Right.
You know.
Well, and that leads to the crux of what I said I think my solution is. One of the things that I think the problem is that, like you said, the hospital has a stake in this. The doctor, now they may not have known this doctor did this,
mm-hmm.
but they certainly have a stake in it, and they don't want it to become public knowledge that this doctor at their hospital did this. So if they can pay somebody a settlement and it doesn't go public, and then quietly just tell that doctor you're going to resign and go somewhere else, that's to their benefit. But it's not necessarily the benefit of the next patient at that next hospital where that doctor goes. So what I suggest is medical malpractice premiums are so high to pay. That's why most doctors will work associated with a hospital rather than open their own practice.
Sure.
Because they're covered under that big policy there rather than having to buy their own. If the government provided malpractice coverage instead of individuals doing it, then every claim that happened would go to the government. The hospital wouldn't have a stake in it. To the hospital, they don't have to try to cover that up. And the government would be making the payments, and the government would keep track of who did this, and they wouldn't just turn them loose to go to another hospital.
Isn't that sort of what the VA system is like?
The VA may be that way.
I wonder, the reason I say that is, and I don't know, because I haven't worked at a VA, but I had did some of my training at a VA, and I learned some things. But my understanding was you can't sue the VA way that you can.
You can't sue the government unless they let you sue them.
I wonder if what you're talking about is more like in the VA system. I don't think they have lawsuits like that. I don't know.
Well, I'm just saying it would, two things. One, it would help control healthcare costs, because it doesn't matter who's paying the premiums, it comes back to the customer. The patient ends up paying it. So that's one thing. Then the other thing is you've got a centralized organization that gets all these malpractice things that come in, so they can better track the doctors that may be involved to decide, hey, this guy shouldn't be practicing, rather than letting him move from hospital to hospital to hospital.
Well, Sydney does bring up a good point, because there is a thing called sovereign immunity where you can't sue the U.S. government,
right,
or actually any government. Governments pass their own laws, and they kind of protect themselves a little bit like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
But if the federal government was the insurer for these doctors or whatnot, then you would probably have some sort of sovereign immunity issue that would pop up, because essentially you'd be making a claim against the government for it. So, I mean, it's interesting.
And that's why it would be in their interest to remove doctors that were not performing properly.
Yeah, I wonder, though, and I don't know. I'm a doctor, so of course I'm going to say this. I mean, I haven't been involved with any cases myself. I know people who have, and the ones I know, this is anecdotal, it's not so much like doctors who are being willfully negligent.
Yeah.
It's just stuff that went wrong.
Some
of it is foreseeable. Some of it is there's risks and there's benefits, and you weigh all that and you make a choice and it doesn't go the way you hoped, and then they get sued. And I mean, I don't know. Again, I'm a doctor, so of course I'm going to say this. I don't think those doctors need to be removed, because I think they're trying to honestly do their best for patients. It's just, we're not God.
Well,
I would say that.
How many people work a 40-year career and don't make a mistake somewhere? It's just that most of us are not operating on people and, you know, have people's lives in our hands. So when we make a mistake, you know, it's not somebody's livelihood or something.
And there are bad doctors. I'm not saying there aren't. There are bad doctors, and there are willfully negligent doctors. Absolutely. I mean, in any profession, there are bad people.
Michael said there are no bad lawyers.
Well, none? I didn't say that. I didn't even say that in this episode.
I was just throwing that out there. I was seeing if you were awake.
Yeah.
You know, they told us once, I do remember one thing they told us about getting sued, and they said that if your bedside manner is good, you're less likely to be sued, whether or not you are you're doing a good job as a doctor. Like, it's almost more important to be nice than it is to be good.
Yeah.
Good doctors get sued. Nice doctors don't often, which I would like to be both. My goal is to be both nice and good, but that was one piece of advice they gave us.
I'm not going to sue my buddy over there.
That's kind of what they
she's
say.
A
like,
good doctor.
Yeah, that even if they're not performing as well, if you're really nice and have a good bedside manner.
That knucklehead cut off my right arm. That's what a scamp.
I'm left-handed anyway.
But I don't know.
Well,
I think that's probably true with lawyers as well.
You think? Degree, yeah.
But there's probably a difference though between a guy's doing his best maybe to save a loved one's life or something like that. And he does what he thinks is the right thing, and maybe in hindsight you find out, well, this would have been better.
Well, sure.
And that's different than the guy sewed up a scalpel inside of you.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a different thing.
Or somebody who's like drunk while they're practicing medicine, or somebody who tries to cut out early and cuts corners and misses things because they weren't paying attention.
Or ask the custodian to go in and perform the operation because he was too tired or something.
That doesn't happen.
Well, I mean, it could.
And doctors are generally held to a reasonable standard of care. And so, basically, if the literature says you should do X, Y, and Z, and then this is what happens, and the doctor relies on that literature, and that's what everybody relies on to do X, Y, and Z, then they're pretty much safe because that's a reasonable standard of care. And they didn't really breach any duty because they were doing what they were kind of trained to do and what's common to be done. So,
you know, just because they didn't save the guy's life doesn't mean they were negligent.
No.
Sure.
Now, there probably will be a lawsuit about it. And that's kind of when somebody dies, there's usually a lawsuit. And that's just unfortunately the way it is.
And the documentation, I think, is what gets a lot of doctors, is that it didn't happen if you didn't write it down. That was one of the things I remember them repeating over and over again. If you didn't write it down, it didn't happen. It doesn't matter if you can sit there and say, no, I remember I absolutely told them this or gave them this risk or did this thing that you're saying I didn't do. If it's not in the notes, it didn't happen. Mm. And so documentation hangs up a lot of doctors because we're busy. We have a lot of stuff to do. We'd rather focus on seeing patients and taking care of people than writing about it. So people cut corners on documentation,
but it's self-defense.
You live or die by that.
It's self-defense if you're a doctor, huh?
Yeah.
Mr. Schmerl knew about the risks associated with this. He went to a class to learn about it.
That's exactly. Well, I mean, that's what all this stuff is about, and it'll be written down somewhere that I thoroughly explained the risks, benefits, alternatives, and side effects of this treatment course, and we both agreed and understood, and that's in every note because otherwise you didn't. Whether or not you did, you didn't.
I'll say I was drinking through the whole class. I have no idea what they said.
I was hammered. So, yeah, I think that's one of the unfortunate things. Even if a doctor does everything right and somebody passes away, just based on the sheer economics of someone dying, there's probably going to be a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of the way it is. I see that also with like auto accidents and things like that. I mean, it could be the person's fault who was driving the car, but if somebody passes away, and there's a little bit of recovery on it. I mean, to be blunt, but there's a dead body's worth money for a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And there's always somebody out there who wants to try to collect on behalf of one of their decedents. You know, they're probably pretty upset somebody passed away, and so, or maybe they're laughing their way to the bank trying to. Who knows?
And one of the things that I read that makes a medical malpractice issue specific to that, as opposed to just general negligence, mm-hmm. is that you have to prove, in a lot of cases, the doctor-patient relationship. You can't, mm-hmm. They give the example, you can't have overheard a doctor at a cocktail party giving advice on something, and then you went and did it, and you got injured, and then turn around and blame that doctor. You didn't have a doctor-patient relationship.
Exactly.
So, you know, you have to look at, was this person actually treating you? Had they been the most current one treating you? You can't have gone to somebody else for a few years and then something happened and you go back and say, well, it was that guy's fault? Mm-hmm. You know, some things like that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it's also very similar to legal malpractice as well, in that if the attorney-client relationship, it has to exist first. And that's one mm-hmm. of those things. Mm-hmm. But it's also kind of a reasonable thing, too. Like, if a doctor comes up to somebody at a cocktail party and says, oh no, you can take a whole bottle of those pills, you're fine, then that doctor might be in trouble. Even though they're at a cocktail party, it's an informal setting, it's reasonable of that person to think that doctor patient relationship existed in that moment. So I think that's one place where, you know, doctors have to be probably pretty careful. Even though it's an informal setting, if they're actually out there dispensing medical advice to somebody and somebody they have a reason to believe that person might rely on that advice, then I think they might be on the hook. So,
well, there's a lot of what ifs there, though.
That's mm-hmm.
Whereas if you're actually the doctor's patient, there's not as much what if.
Yeah, but that's why I have a disclaimer at the beginning of my podcast.
Well, we do too.
Yeah.
I don't want anybody doing what I say. You know, people might go out and follow my advice.
Dear Lord, don't follow what Tommy says. Or what I say, for that matter. That's part of the disclaimer.
Yeah. Or what I say, because
that's right.
Go see your own doctor.
One of the other things that enters into medical malpractice is you have to prove that the doctor was actually negligent. You can't just be unhappy with your treatment or your outcome or something like that. Maybe it wasn't the desired outcome that you wanted, or maybe it wasn't as great. But if he did what he was supposed to do, then it's not negligence just mm-hmm. because it didn't work
sure.
or whatever. So, you know, there's that has to be proven. The doctor's negligence has to have caused the injury. Like, you know, they kind of like give the example, if you were being treated for lung cancer and the doctor performed some kind of procedure and you ended up dying during that procedure, it could, and they could it could be assumed, well, you were already dying from lung cancer. So the procedure he did was to save you. He didn't actually kill you because the cancer was going to kill you anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think as long as that doctor followed standard treating guidelines to do what they were supposed to do, then it's probably fine. Now, if they did some other crazy thing like, all right, we're going to open him up and put some leeches in there and let the leeches suck out the cancer. Mm-hmm. That's probably not...
Yeah, it's got to be something accepted. Yeah. That's what I say. It has to be something that the guy was trying his best.
Yeah.
And if he stuck leeches in you, he probably wasn't trying his best.
And not only trying his best, but trying his best within accepted medical practice. Because I know of cases of doctors who were trying their best and using experimental therapies that had not been approved on the basis that this is better than nothing. It's the only thing we've got. That's not good enough.
Yeah.
That's not good enough. It has to be accepted medical practice.
And one of the other things is the injury has to have led to specific damages. Physical pain, mental anguish, additional medical bills, and lost work or lost earning capacity.
Yep.
It can't just be that you're upset or something like that. Yeah. You know? And the common types of medical malpractice are failure to diagnose.
Yeah, that's a scary one.
Yeah.
That's the one that keeps a lot of us up at night.
Well, and that's
the fear that you'll miss something, no matter how hard you work, that you'll just miss something.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I think even doctors recommend you should go get a second opinion. Mm-hmm. That nobody, I think, will ever say, hey, if I tell you that's the way it is, that's the way it is. I think any of them will tell you, go get a second, get a third opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I was surprised when I was watching a 48 hours or prime time or something like that, one of those news shows, and it was talking about breast cancer diagnosis. They're subjective, the people that read those, as to whether I just thought it was like you hold it up, you look, oh, there's cancer, or you have a tumor, you know, we have to see if it's malignant or not. But there's things there all the time that somebody has to determine, yes, we need to check it, or no, we don't. Whenever you're in that type of category, you line up 100 doctors and you're not going to have 100 of the same decision, most likely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think those are probably the areas of practice where the insurance premiums are the highest, probably too.
Yeah, yeah. Mammography is fraught with those kinds of issues.
So that's really scary. Improper treatment, if a doctor prescribed a certain course of treatment that was just not in line with that injury or disease or something like that, you know, that would be one. And then failure to warn a patient of known risks. So if you say, we're going to start you on this, but you don't tell them, oh, by the way, it could make you blind. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm blind. Oh, yeah. Didn't I tell you about that?
You have to have an informed patient.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They have to know what the risks are. I think that was what in Sydney, when she went off on her little diatribe, what she puts into her notes there. I think that was part of the verbiage that I heard.
Yep. Informed consent. Every patient. That's right.
And, you know, you were talking about different states. You were talking about the requirements for West Virginia. You had to have the letter from a doctor.
Yeah, because there is no, and just to clear it up, there is no kind of federal medical malpractice law. It differs state by state. Each state enacts their own legislation. So,
well, I came across this just in the paper today. It says that in Kentucky, there's a panel that was established to review all medical malpractice claims before the lawsuits can be filed. Mm-hmm. It said that they are severely backlogged, though. And that it shows that only 11% of 531 claims had been assigned in the Medical Review Panel Act's first year on the books. Finding their findings have been issued in just 3% of the cases, with another 5% withdrawn, settled, or dismissed. And so they're saying, hey, this isn't working. And the reason they did it was the same type of thing as West Virginia.
Yeah.
They were trying to get rid of the frivolous lawsuits and try to make it more friendly to businesses and things to be here. Mm-hmm. And not have to worry about the lawsuits. And now you've got this panel isn't working because they're not getting the cases through there. So here's all these people, and some of them may be really seriously injured and have a case, and nothing's happening with it.
Yeah, and I think that's a lot of the insurance companies lobby and their advertising that really want to push that agenda. So that's just my two cents about it.
Yeah, that's just really the medical malpractice is just one leg of the problem with healthcare costs. And it gets focus, I think, depending on which side of the political spectrum you're on, because it falls in line with some political rhetoric. But
yeah,
that's yes, there are issues there, but that's just
there's
one,
a lot of components.
That's one piece of the puzzle. There's so many others.
Yeah. And I didn't mean that was going to solve all the healthcare problems. I said that, I was just saying that might be a way to help solve that piece.
I'll tell you what, everybody wants medical malpractice reform until it's your loved one that something happens to.
Sure.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, there are some interesting famous medical malpractice cases that we came across when we're researching this topic, and we thought it might be interesting to impart those to you, the listeners.
Well, of course it would be.
These are going to scare me.
That's why we're here.
The first one is somebody we know from Saturday Night Live, Dana Carvey.
Dana Carvey? Really?
Yeah. In 2001, USA Today reported that Dana Carvey had a medical malpractice case, and he had a bypass surgery, and it was about 2 months after the double bypass operation in 2001, which was supposed to help him live. He received news that the surgeon had bypassed one of the wrong arteries. The surgeon who performed the surgery stated that it was an honest mistake that occurred due to the unusual positioning of Mr. Carvey's artery in his heart. He was pretty upset, and he filed a $7.5 million lawsuit against the surgeon in the hospital.
So, did they correct it, or is he still hooked up wrong? He's still alive.
I don't know. We'll never know.
How would you find out 2 years after the fact that you had one hooked up wrong?
Probably had a cath. Probably had a heart cath.
Oh, he went back in. He was having further problems or something.
Either
maybe.
That or just sometimes they'll just reassess periodically. I don't know if that's... It's not always necessarily founded in evidence, but sometimes that happens. So it could have been that, or he was having problems. Who knows?
Problems like, wait a second.
Yeah. And they did a heart cath and went, well, they didn't bypass that artery. It's still blocked.
Man.
Some doctor was like, let me look at the notes. Mm-hmm. Well, it's supposed to have been.
That can happen. Unusual position of arteries. There are, I don't know what his specific case is, but that does happen. There are cases like that.
Well, I guess everybody's a little bit different. I've heard different terms. Different people have different tilted organs in different ways and stuff like that.
Or like situs inversus, where everything's flipped on the opposite side of where you'd expect it.
I know there was some mom had some sort of surgery, and I remember the surgeon said something. Well, God just made her that way. Something was in a weird place.
That just happens sometimes.
I saw a picture of a kid that his heart was born on the outside of him. I mean, he was born with his heart on the outside of him.
That's pretty unusual.
They had to put it back in.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to fix that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, you don't want your heart on the outside.
No, you can wear your heart on your sleeve, but not on your chest.
Oh, my Lord. I was about to make that same joke.
You've been hanging around me too long.
Oh, Mike.
You better take a drink.
You're going to be laughing at duty the next thing you know.
There was another lady, and she was given the pseudonym of Joan Morris. And she was admitted, she was 6-7 years old, and she was admitted to a teaching hospital, and she had a cerebral angiography performed. And after the procedure was completed, she returned to a hospital room on a different floor than her original one. Instead of being discharged as planned the next morning, she was whisked away to have an open heart procedure performed. After having been upon the operating table for over an hour, a doctor from a different department was called and asked what they were doing with his patient. Once the mistake was realized, the procedure was canceled and Miss Morris was returned to her room in stable condition. However, the potential consequences of the extra surgery performed include significantly increased risk of heart attack, stroke, internal bleeding, and infections. So,
did she have surgery?
They started on her, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I came across that same one, and they said one of the things that contributed to it is the reason it got them in is she was scheduled, but then they had an opening in the OR. So they brought her in, moved her up on her schedule, but forgot to tell everybody, oh, this isn't the person that was there. So they were doing the one that was scheduled instead of the one that she was there for.
Whew.
Yeah, it's the same thing where, like you said, everybody agrees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, this is what we're supposed to be doing here.
Yeah.
But nobody checked to see, is this the right Jane Morris? Evidently, she had a similar name.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the exact same name, but it was very similar.
There's another case. This is a very sawbones type one. Just for what happened, because a surgeon drilled a hole in the wrong side of someone's head.
Oh.
Surgeons at a Rhode Island hospital had performed surgery on the wrong side of a patient's head for the third time in one calendar year, it said. This particular incident occurred in November of 2007. An 82-year-old patient required the operation to stem the flow of bleeding from her brain to her skull. The surgeon immediately started the procedure off incorrectly by drilling a hole in the wrong side of the patient's skull. This action occurred despite the fact that a CAT scan performed only moments before indicated that the bleeding was happening on the left side of the brain. The mistake was actually caught early on, and the resident surgeon closed the initial hole and proceeded to the correct side of the patient's head. And although the patient survived the surgery in fair condition, two other similar incidents happened, and they occurred within the last year, one of which resulted in the death of an 86-year-old man. So this Rhode Island hospital apparently is just drilling holes in people's heads all willy-nilly. I don't know.
Yeah, that Rhode Island, that was, and it was a teaching hospital where the students of Brown University go to.
And this is giving teaching hospitals a really bad name.
And one of them, because I came across that one too, one of the other ones of the three mm-hmm. that they had happen, they both, there was like the surgeon and the assistant surgeon that were in mm-hmm. on it, they both agreed which side they were working on, that it was the left side or whatever, they both agreed on it, and then proceeded to work on the right side. Even though they both sat there at the beginning and said they were going to work on the left and worked on the right. So I don't know. I guess it depends on, did you mean your left or his left?
I don't know. I could come up with a million reasons how those things could happen, but 3 in 1 year seems like something is going wrong.
Yeah. I wouldn't go to that hospital for brain surgery.
That seems, yeah.
What do you think? It's not brain surgery. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
I think I saw a skit like that. It was some British skit. And it's like, it's not exactly brain surgery. And the guy was a brain surgeon.
Yep, it was. Now, I found one that was, it's like a horror movie mm-hmm. of something that would happen to somebody. It said that this lady had long suffered pain in her right eye, and at the advice of her doctor, they decided her quality of life would be improved if she had the eye removed. The surgery was 5.5 hours long, and for about 2 of those hours, Carol was awake. She explained that anesthesia is made up of 2 different elements, one to paralyze the patient and one to put them to sleep.
Oh.
Unfortunately, only the paralyzing agent worked fully in her case. So she was fully awake through the whole thing, just unable to move or respond. And she said she could hear the surgeon listening to disco music throughout. Well, right there, that should be pain and suffering.
Disco music, operating on your eye.
As well as having to hear things like cut deeper and pull harder.
Oh.
So it said that she was so traumatized by the ordeal that she now sleeps in a reclining chair since she's too afraid to lie down. Cases like these are known as anesthesia awareness, and it is estimated that up to 42,000 people in the U.S. alone experience it every year.
Yeah.
I hope you're not one of them.
I do, too.
I've heard of these
cases. I'm
going to
get 2. They're going to knock me out and then give me a spinal. So even if I wake up, I shouldn't feel anything anyway if I've got a spinal.
Right. I mean, because like with my C-section, I was awake the whole time.
Yeah.
I knew what they were doing, but
that's what
I didn't
Mom
feel
said.
It.
She said I was lucky because she said, we get spinals and we have to be awake. You're not even going to be awake for yours.
Yeah, it's weird because you can feel pressure. You can feel pulling and tugging.
Yeah.
And like, since I've watched C-sections, I know what they were doing. I didn't see it.
I just reminded her, I have man pain.
That's
much
true.
Worse
pain
than
way
woman
more
pain.
Intense,
I had surgery
obviously.
Yeah?
I had a nose job.
Yeah?
Yeah. I had, from where I've broken my nose so many times.
Oh, I thought it was so you could be on GQ.
That's right. I want to look like David Hasselhoff. From playing soccer. And I was a goalkeeper and I...
You were having trouble breathing, weren't you?
Well, sometimes I would not stop the ball with my hands. I would stop it with my face.
Mm.
So, you know, whatever it took.
That's
right. Whatever it takes. Yeah.
Anyway, I had to get I had a deviated septum and they actually had to take cartilage from my septum and then rebuild my nasal valves to like, because my nose was collapsing and they had to kind of bore out my turbinates too. But anyway, they knocked me completely out for that. Like I didn't know anything that happened. So, and it didn't.
That's
really
the best way.
It didn't really hurt too bad until I think it was 2 days later. I felt like Arnold Schwarzenegger in Total Recall when he had
everything
warned
off
of his nose.
Yeah.
Oh, the burn.
You know, in my experience, most surgeons did listen to music in the OR. Like when I was a student, because we had certain surgeons you liked working with better because their musical taste was so much better.
Well, you remember you were in there with me when Riley was born,
mm-hmm.
and the song that became her song played on the radio moment of her birth.
Mm-hmm.
What was it?
Creed, Arms Wide Open.
Ooh.
You don't like that choice?
Creed.
Yeah. Well, I know what you think about Creed, but that's still a good song.
Hey, I saw Creed.
I don't care. I challenge
Creed
you.
I saw a concert at the Drop Shop here in Huntington back in college.
Wow. They were good. All right, now.
Rockin' show.
Coming up on my surgery here.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
Coming up on my surgery here, one of the questions I would not think to ask my surgeon is, what if I catch on fire? I mean, that just wouldn't come up in the conversation or in my concerns.
Typically shouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Well, however, we do have quite a few cases. As a matter of fact, It is estimated that surgical fires affect up to 650 patients a year. And I have a list of several injuries there I won't go into where people just actually ignited and either suffered burns or died on the operating table.
I can see where that would happen, though, with a mixture of the fact that we're using like oxygen and things like that.
Laser tools.
And we use like cautery, electric cautery and things that throw off sparks and things while you're... Yeah, I can see where that would...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 650 patients a year. That seems rather high, doesn't it?
It does. I've never witnessed that.
I thought I was going to have surgery. Instead, they invited me to a barbecue. It was me.
I don't think that would be your attitude.
No. You'd probably be mad.
All right. Now, it's not uncommon that you have surgeries where people find out that they have foreign objects still inside of them that they didn't have before they went in for surgery. And it's estimated that there's about 1,500 such reports every year in the U.S. Mm-hmm. This one, though, is set apart from the others in the fact that the item left behind inside this man's chest was a retractor that was 10 inches long, and it could physically be seen from the outside, the outline of it, and poking out of his skin. And yet, when he went back into the University of Pittsburgh to complain about it, he was told he should seek psychiatric care. After a month of agonizing pain and multiple complaints and repeatedly being told the problem was in his head, he finally was given a CAT scan and the item was removed. He then began legal proceedings.
That's wild.
You could see it in his chest where it was left in there.
And then something also went wrong there, because at the end of every surgery, they do a count. And before you can close the patient, the scrub tech, the nurse who's responsible for like handing the surgeon things and assisting with the procedure, will do a count of everything. So ahead of time, you know exactly how many pieces of gauze, how many forceps, how many sutures, how many whatever,
all this
stuff.
For all that to come back
and so
out.
At the end, you count again to make sure everything matches. Specifically because, I mean, I could see where, I don't know how a retractor gets left behind, but I can see where like they have dozens of little teeny pieces of gauze that they're using.
Sure.
You can see where one of those might get left. But they count them all to prevent that.
I read about a case, I think it was in like 99, 2000, where actually a mixtape featuring Creed, Arms Wide Open, was actually left inside of a patient. And it was kind of a big ordeal.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, the Creed mixtape left inside, that's a big problem.
Does mom know? Or?
Let's not tell her.
Don't tell her.
When you push her belly button, it plays.
Wide open. What was that? Nothing.
Now, this was a really sad story here. This was a 17-year-old girl that received a heart and double lung transplant and shortly died thereafter. And it was because they found out she was type O and the heart and lungs was type A. And that you'd think, what was this at like Walmart hospital or something where they wouldn't check the blood type for it to go through. This was Duke University Hospital. There was supposed to be about a dozen people who were supposed to check this, and it fell through the cracks. Nobody ever looked to see that the blood type matched.
When we talk about mistakes, like in, we do grand rounds that are called morbidity and mortality rounds, M&M rounds, where you kind of go through things that happened that were less than ideal to try to troubleshoot and come up with like problem analysis. How can we prevent these things from happening in the future? And a lot of times we refer to it as the Swiss cheese effect. When things go wrong in a hospital, it's typically because all the holes lined up. There are multiple levels where things should be caught. We have so many fail safes and checks to try to prevent stuff like this. And usually when a big mistake happens, it's because multiple levels failed all at the same time.
Storm.
Yeah.
People think, well, it'll get caught at this point, or I don't need a check, or, oh, I'm sure somebody's looked at that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it didn't get taken
care
of.
I'm sure somebody's looked at it. That's a dangerous mindset.
Now, the last one I got, this is kind of, this one I'm not even sure where it falls. This is almost more of an ethical thing than it was an actual medical malpractice. It said that this boy was born to this couple. He had one leg and no arms. Now, of course, the deformity was not the fault of the medical staff, but they claim the doctor should have told them ahead of time, should have known ahead of time, that their son was going to be born deformed, and should have notified them of that so they would have the option of having an abortion. And so that's what they were claiming medical malpractice on. And they said that they had discussed having an amniocentesis and told the doctor that they didn't want to have a child born with any deformities. And they were going to have an amniocentesis. And he said, I can tell you that with your age and health and everything else, 99% your baby's going to be healthy. If you want to have an amniocentesis, we'll do it. But there's a 1 in 500 chance you could have a miscarriage when we do that.
Which there is a risk. That's
and,
true.
And they said that they had he had shown them two ultrasounds that showed everything intact. You know, everything was all right. And so they went ahead and had the baby and then was born this way. So they said, well, if you had told us, we'd have probably had an abortion. Since you didn't tell us and we have this child, we want you to pay now for the cost of having this child for the rest of our lives.
Yeah.
So they ended up getting $4.5 million.
That's a tricky one.
There was a huge article like that just last year, I think I read, and it was a similar case. A mom was suing because she had asked for the cystic fibrosis testing ahead of time, and they'd done it, and they never gave her the results. And so it was positive, and she says that if she had known ahead of time, she would have had an abortion. Yeah. But since they had the results, they never told her the results. She had the baby. Of course, the baby has CF, and... But it was she was discussing like how she feels as a mom suing on the basis that she wouldn't have her child, who she absolutely loves, adores, and would do anything in the world for. But at the same time, she is suing this provider, and I don't know.
I wonder if the person
it's a very complicated ethical.
I wonder if the medical people she dealt with knew that that was her feeling.
I don't know.
I mean, if she said, "I'm going to abort it if it is." And then they deliberately withheld that.
I doubt that.
Or was it just an oversight?
It was just a total oversight. The result came back, and one person thought another person told her, and somebody else thought somebody else told her. And
why wouldn't she have ever followed up and asked? Hey, I never heard anything back on that test. I don't know. Assumed they would have told her if they had to do something. Yeah.
That is assumed a lot. And I don't remember. I mean, it's been a year or so I don't remember all the little details of the case, but it was a very sticky ethical situation.
I got two others that are just very lighthearted ones after all these heavy ones.
All right. Let's end on some good, fun medical malpractice cases.
I have a historical one for you, too, when you're done.
Ooh.
All right. We'll save yours for last because you're the guest, and yours will probably be the best. The case of the dancing doctor. Because surgery can be a stiff, quiet affair, Dr. Wendell Boutte, B-O-U-T-T-E, I guess that's Boutte, a dermatologist in Georgia decided to spice it up a little. Once her patients, that was a lady. Once her patients were deep into anesthetic naps, Dr. Boutte became DJ Boutte and produced full-fledged rap videos, leading to a comfy side career as a YouTube sensation. She could even be seen doing a rousing rendition mid-liposuction of Flo Rida's Apple Bottom Jeans. But
the apple bottom jeans.
Dr. Boutte now claims that her patients not only consented but requested the videos. They wanted to celebrate their surgeries, and yet Boutte is now facing complaints from over 100 women, and 7 malpractice suits have been filed against her by patients who claim the dancing doctor left them disfigured. And then this last one is titled DIY. Pop quiz for all you handymen out there in the midst of a big project. You realize you're missing a key piece. Say, for instance, you're performing back surgery and realize you've forgotten titanium rods you were going to use to brace a patient's back. Shucks, what do you do? Well, you improvise, of course.
Oh, no.
Taking the sound advice of overly frugal uncles the world round, Dr. Robert Ricketson decided to forego patience and just improvised his missing titanium rods. He did this by hacksawing the shaft off of a stainless steel screwdriver and inserting that into his patient's spine. The stainless steel screwdriver, not as strong as titanium, it turns out, snapped days later. The patient's family sued for millions in damages, and Dr. Rickston was left to try and duct tape his reputation back together.
Must not have been a craftsman.
Sure, yeah, don't do that. Who would?
Why would you just call it off? You don't have it, call it off.
Which is almost every single surgeon would do.
I think that would be the standard of care that would be reasonable.
Well, apparently at least one would do his best to you know, soldier on and make the best of the situation and get you that operation, even if you've got a hack sawed off screwdriver shoved in your spine.
I mean, that's the guy I want climbing a mountain with me, but I don't necessarily think I want him operating on me.
I don't want him doing back surgery on me, huh?
No, you want that guy on Survivor.
Yeah. But not there. Not there. Not my doctor.
Well, make it clear to your surgeon ahead of time that if he doesn't have what he needs for your knee, just, you know, close you up and bring you back later.
Well, now, what I wouldn't mind.
It's cool.
Well, yeah, what I wouldn't mind is if he put in one with like a couple of heavy duty springs that were in the knee and I got like a 50 inch vertical out of it, then I could go back to playing ball. That's what got me here in the first place.
You want some Inspector Gadget knees.
Uh-huh. Yeah, go gadget knees.
There was a case. This is not a malpractice case because this was back in the 1800s. And so doctors probably got away with a lot of stuff back then.
Well, they were only paid in cows and pigs. So
And this is pre-anesthesia. So if you were a surgeon pre-anesthesia, you had to be pretty fast with your surgeries.
Sure.
Because your patient was in pain.
Or get them real drunk.
Sometimes. Whatever you had, whatever you could do, it was that or bite on a stick. Robert Lisson was a famous surgeon back in the 1800s who was known to be like the fastest knife in London. And that was how he kind of made a name for himself, because he would time, like he would like stride into the operating room and tell like the students and residents, like, time me, boys, time me, and start chopping away as fast as he could. He was quite a character, but one of his surgeries is famous for having a 300% mortality rate.
300%?
Mm-hmm. Because during the procedure that he was, I think he was trying to remove a patient's leg, he also accidentally cut off the fingers of his surgical assistant while he was swiping his scalpel back and forth quickly. And during the surgery, he cut off like the coattails of one of the observers, because it was common at the time to have a lot of like fancy gentleman observers there to watch the surgeons. He like slashed through his coattails, and supposedly the guy died of a heart attack out of fright when he attacked him with the scalpel. So the patient died, because this was pre-antibiotics. A lot of people died in surgery back then. The patient died, the surgical assistant got his wound infected and died, and the guy watching died.
Well, so, man,
300% mortality rate.
That was better than a BOGO.
That's crazy. What was that guy's name again?
Robert Liston.
Don't ever schedule an appointment with him.
Fastest knife in the OR.
Mm-hmm. We don't do it that way anymore.
Results guaranteed. Not good results, but results.
I don't think I want that guy operating on me.
Me neither. Like I don't want him operating on me.
Swing. What is it? The play with the barber? Sweeney Todd?
Oh, Sweeney Todd.
Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's going to bring us to
Legal Breeze.
Legal Breeze is the part of the show.
Where was I supposed to do that too?
We
wasn't ready.
Nobody's ever ready.
They're never ready.
Legal Breeze is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms that we just talked about. We're going to start with one that I've asked time and time again. What are the elements of negligence?
Duty.
And?
Breach.
Yep.
And, injury.
Damages.
Yeah. Ooh, look at Sid. Yeah, that's
duty, breach, damages, and cause.
Cause. Yay! Yeah. You got it.
It was like CDBG or something. I was trying to remember my letters there.
DBCD.
Yeah.
I think that's how I remembered it.
Heebie-jeebies. It gives me the heebie-jeebies. I always get duty.
That was a team effort. Now, before you file a lawsuit, you have to get a pre-screening letter. And it's sometimes called a what?
Pre-certification.
Maybe.
Oh.
Pre-screening letter.
Merit. Letter of merit.
That's right. Look at Sid. Sid's knocking it out of the park.
She's a doctor.
Yeah.
She's my kid.
That's my girl.
I knew I had it in there. I was thinking, what's it called?
And all right, this is a West Virginia specific one. What is the statute of limitations for medical malpractice in West Virginia?
Two years.
Look at that. Yeah. That's 100%. I don't think we've ever had such a success rate. Such a test rate on Legal Briefs.
You can't keep two good smurls down.
No.
Right. Well, Sid, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
We greatly appreciate, Lil Bean, that you joined us.
Anytime.
Well, all right. We had a topic right up her alley.
Yeah.
Well, not really. I mean, not that she knows a lot about it, because she hasn't been involved in it.
When you think medical malpractice, you think Dr. McElroy.
No, that doesn't make a good ad at all.
Let's hope not.
Scratch that ad. Scratch that.
Let's hope I never have to learn any more than this.
Strike that from the jury.
Well, Tommy, good luck with your surgery. I'm excited to see you in November on the Turkey Bowl field. Maybe.
I'm hoping to get my second one done in November, so I'll still be laid up then. But I'll have my 42-inch vertical or 50-inch vertical or whatever.
We'll wheel you around out there in a...
There we go.
Strap me to the gurney and stand it up, and I'll just stand there and throw the ball. I'll be all-time quarterback. You all wheel me. I'll get one of my dollies from work, and you all can strap me to the dolly and move me up and down the field.
Oh, don't we have to get your shoulder fixed first before you can throw the ball?
I'll have to throw left-handed.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I'm not getting the shoulder replacement because it limits me too much. I can only lift 10 pounds with that arm from then on.
Yeah.
Babies weigh more than 10 pounds. I can't do that.
That's true.
Yeah.
Especially mine.
That's right. So I got to keep, I just can't lift them above my head. I can lift them up, you know, shoulder height. That's it.
That's okay. You're really tall. I don't want you lifting them above your head anyway. What are they doing up there? That's dangerous.
Dad, what are you doing?
Put her down. Put her down.
She jumped up there. I didn't know how to get her off.
No.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.